From Silver Hollow Audio and Radio Catskill, this is Cat's Cast. I'm Brett Barry, and each week we bring you stories and conversations rooted right here in our mountains and valleys. Local culture, history, sustainability, nature, literature, and the arts, and lots more. Coming up, a conversation with Ken Posner and his new book, Chasing the Grid, an ultra runner's physical and spiritual journey in pursuit of the ultimate mountain challenge.
I think the mountains like it. They like it when people go out and try, but they'll also throw some challenges your way.
And then an autumnal hiking challenge for everyone.
It's not about how far you go or climbing the highest peak. It's about getting out there and advocating and spreading the message of the Trail Conference and supporting the advancement of our mission.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The Trump administration says more than 4,000 federal employees have received layoff notices, and officials say that number is subject to change. NPR's Stephen Fowler has more.
About 4,200 people across seven agencies were slated to receive reduction in force notices Friday, including about 1,500 in the Treasury Department and 1,200 at the Department of Health and Human Services. Earlier in the day, the White House Budget Office called the layoffs, quote, substantial, and President Trump said the cuts would be, quote, a lot. After earlier cuts to the federal workforce made by the DOGE effort and voluntary buyouts, there are about 2 million civilian federal employees. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Atlanta.
An annual flu shot can reduce the chance of getting very sick this flu season, and now may be a good time to get one. NPR's Ping Huang reports.
Health officials recommend getting the flu vaccine before Halloween so you develop antibodies before flu cases start picking up. Fiona Havers is an infectious diseases doctor, formerly with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Every year, the flu vaccine is effective in decreasing your risk of severe disease, including hospitalization and death. And so people should get their flu vaccine every year.
Last flu season was bad. At least 43 million people got sick, and more than 500,000 got hospitalized, leading to the highest rate in more than a decade. Over the past few months, the new flu vaccine cut doctor's visits and hospitalizations in the Southern Hemisphere by around 50%, according to estimates in a CDC weekly report. Flu season south of the equator typically runs from April to September and is often a harbinger for the Northern Hemisphere. Ping Huang, NPR News.
As a ceasefire in Gaza holds, rescue workers have been retrieving bodies from the rubble after Israeli troops pulled back from some areas. The BBC's Hugo Bashega reports an estimated 200,000 Palestinians have already returned to neighborhoods in the north of the territory.
Obviously, there is the joy that has been brought by the ceasefire, finally some peace for the population in Gaza. But there's also a lot of sadness, desperation caused by the scale of the destruction in Gaza. A lot of people are returning home only to find out that there's nothing left to go back to. So medical teams are also now searching for bodies under the rubble of collapsed buildings. The authorities are saying that more than 100 bodies have been recovered so far, and thousands more are expected to be retrieved.
The BBC's Hugo Bashega reporting. Health officials in Gaza say they retrieved the remains of 116 people who had been killed earlier in the war but couldn't be retrieved until the Israeli troops left. Meanwhile, in Israel, authorities found the body of a man who had survived the Hamas attack 2 years ago when his girlfriend had been killed. He left a post on Instagram that he couldn't go on anymore. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Democrats are coming together to denounce the Justice Department's indictment of New York Attorney General Letitia James. From the New York Public News Network, WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports.
Rival candidates held a joint press conference. Progressives and moderates talked about fighting tyranny. Tish James's indictment has become a rallying point for Democrats in New York. L. Joy Williams is president of the state's NAACP chapter. She says people are eager to attend rallies.
Like, everybody is using their infrastructure to rally behind Tish, but also to rally against the White House. And I think it's an important moment to demonstrate that unity.
After weeks of pressure from President Trump, prosecutors charged James with two counts related to mortgage fraud. James says the case is baseless and politically motivated. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR News. Thanks for sticking with us.
It's Leila Fadel. Thank you for having our back.
It's A. Martinez. Thank you for staying informed with us.
It's Michelle Martin. Thank you for trusting us.
Thank you for supporting this station.
Thank you for supporting this station.
Thank you for supporting this station.
We'll get through this together.
Support Radio Catskill at WJFFradio.org. Thanks.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org.
I think the mountains like it. They like it when people go out and try. But they'll also throw some challenges your way. Rain or getting lost or running low on food and injuries and unfriendly animals. All that sort of stuff. That's part of the game.
From Silver Hollow Audio and Radio Catskill, this is Cats Cast. I'm Brett Barry, and each week we bring you stories and conversations rooted right here in our mountains and valleys. This series takes shape from a documentary-style podcast by the same name, and this weekly radio hour aims to expand the narrative with extended interviews, pertinent updates, and original storytelling for you, our radio listeners. To say that Ken Posner enjoys a good challenge might be an understatement. A former Army Ranger and decades-long Wall Street analyst, Ken now serves as senior VP at the nation's largest mortgage servicer. During his downtime, Ken likes to decompress with competitive outdoor adventures and a bit of record breaking here and there. He's run more than 100 marathon length races, completed the 350-mile long path in record time, thru-hiked the John Muir Trail, and he's now on a quest to climb 1,000 mountains barefoot. On his website, barefootken.com, he lists as some of the motivations for this self-created challenge the calmness which comes from focusing on the basic act of movement, the spirit of adventure, and a sense of light-footedness. The challenge we're focusing on today, however, is chronicled in Ken's new book, Chasing the Grid, An Ultra Runner's Physical and Spiritual Journey in Pursuit of the Ultimate Mountain Challenge. You may have heard about the Catskill 3500 Club and requirements for membership. Those being climbing to the summits of 33 peaks over 3,500 feet and repeating 4 of those hikes in the winter. So, 37 summits. The grid goes 12 times further, pushing participants to climb 35 Catskill high peaks in every month of the calendar year. So, 35 peaks, 12 climbs each, that's 420 hikes, climbs, and in Ken's case, a bit of barefoot running and a minimalist approach to sustenance and gear. For Ken, challenges like the grid transcend athleticism. It's a spiritual practice, each step connecting him to the earth and echoing the transcendentalist ethos of luminaries like Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson. Some of the passages in Ken's new book, in fact, tie very closely to 19th century nature writing. The Catskills' own John Burroughs would feel at home reading Ken's descriptions of mountain flora along the trail. Ken's meditative observations and metaphorical prose serve as a counterpoint to prior challenges where raw speed was the name of the game. Chasing the Grid is Ken Posner's chronicle of a new kind of challenge, embracing purpose, patience, and introspection. Stick around for a streamside chat with Ken Posner on mountains, movement, and mindfulness. First up, that conversation with Ken, and later, we check in with Jennifer Zack at the New York New Jersey Trail Conference about a hike-a-thon-style fundraising challenge open to everyone, regardless of experience or ability, through the end of October.
Well, hello, everybody. My name is Ken Posner, and just to keep things short, I'm a runner, I'm a financial analyst, and I'm trying to be a writer as well.
Well, more than trying, you're now in your third book, right? So can you tell me, first of all, the first two books that I know of, Stalking the Black Swan and Running the Long Path, and even though Black Swan has a natural sound to it, it's a totally different book. So can you just give me a sense of what those two books are about and how they kind of tell us what your life is about in a way?
Sure. And I've spent years working on Wall Street and then in corporate America. And Stalking the Black Swan was about my role as a research analyst. And it's, of course, inspired by Nassim Taleb's concept of the Black Swan, which is that huge surprise which turns people's worlds upside down, like the GFC, the great financial crash. Running the Long Path was about setting a record for the Long Path back in 2013, when I was spending a lot of time doing ultra running, and I became aware of this mysterious path with the aqua blazes. And that was a huge adventure for me and a huge challenge. And it was a great introduction to the beauty of the Hudson Valley and particularly the Catskills, as the Long Path goes straight through the Catskills on its way to the Capital District.
So we've done an episode on the Long Path with Casey Kelbaugh, who wrote an article about it for the New York Times. His goal was not to do it quickly. His goal was to do it and to get from his place in the city to his place in the Catskills. But what was your goal with the Long Path and that achievement?
Well, my goal was to break the record. And so this was, I had just turned 50 years old. And the question for me was, could I step up to something bigger and tougher than I had ever done before? And could I move myself through nature unaided, using just a little bit of equipment, and cover the ground in the way that I imagine our ancestors used to do back in the day when, you know, there weren't roads or even much in the way of paths, but they had to be out in the environment to hunt and scout and trade. And so I was in part trying to reenact a little bit of that connection, but also I wanted to see what I could do and if I could push the throttle forward and engage the afterburners and really get out there at speed.
So what was the record and breaking that record? What are some numbers attached to that?
Well, the record had been 12 days, and I was trying to get out there in 7 days, and I fell short of that. I finished it in 9 days. And since then, by the way, some very talented runners have gone out there. The Long Path has attracted a lot of attention. A fellow named Jeff Adams has the current record, which is around 7 days. Kim Levinsky just went out last year and set the record for women. And so she had a huge adventure getting caught in torrential rainstorms. And I had rainstorms, too. When you go out and do something like this, I think the mountains like it. They like it when people go out and try. But they'll also throw some challenges your way. Rain or getting lost and running low on food and injuries and unfriendly animals, all that sort of stuff. That's part of the game.
And so for you, 9 days took you from what was point A and what was point B?
Point A was right across the George Washington Bridge in New York City. And the trail, the northern terminus of the trail, is in the Thatcher Park, the Heidelberg Escarpment overlooking Albany.
So your career and hobby includes a lot of challenges and, you know, pushing yourself. Where does that come from? And give me a little sense of some of the other challenges that you've engaged in.
Well, sure. And you know, I had and continue to have a corporate job, which is similar to many people. And corporate jobs are demanding and they can be stressful because of the competition and the volatility in the markets and the high expectations that investors and the leaders in the companies have for everybody who's involved. So over time, I began to balance that out with running. And in fact, I saw colleagues, you know, getting sick. And that's a challenge in today's world for everybody. Health is not to be taken for granted. I was promoted on a couple of occasions because other people had health issues and dropped out. And that was a bit of a troubling pattern. I thought, you know, in my late 30s, early 40s, I needed to start investing in myself if I was going to sustain myself for the long term. So I got back into running, and I got into marathons, and I gradually got into ultra marathons. And it was a great formula for many years. It was like sort of a barbell approach to life. On the one hand, you know, the super intense work environment, super high tech, but all sort of digital, analytical, you know, sharp pencil kind of work. And on the other hand, getting out into nature. And it wasn't just about the speed, but it was about the intensity and the effort. And that's what I didn't always get from the desk job.
In fact, you said in your book, and I'll ask you to read this if you wouldn't mind.
The long sedentary hours inside my windowless office were becoming difficult to endure. Staring at the screen, I felt my body going slack and my mood turning stale. There was this nagging thought, as irritating as a splinter, that something was wrong with the world. Here I was working endlessly for money, but money to spend on what? On fancy food and drink? Expensive clothes? A renovated and redecorated apartment? In other words, on things that didn't matter. Whereas there was such vast wealth, namely the joy and beauty experience outdoors, available for free.
That section of the book is called The Life of Quiet Desperation, which comes from Henry David Thoreau.
And that's right. And I went through a part in my life where work hit sort of a plateau or an air pocket for various reasons, which gave me more time to run. But I began to struggle with some chronic injuries. And suddenly I realized I was at risk of becoming one of these quietly desperate people. And that was not appealing to me.
And this led to?
So this led to the grid. So the grid was a huge pivot for me. It was a pivot from what I had been doing with ultra running to a different kind of project.
You dedicate this book to your mom and dad. I don't know who you dedicated the first two books to, but I'm wondering if there's any significance other than the obvious, which is that they're your mom and dad. Any connection to this particular book?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm a big believer, as you can tell, in getting outdoors and experiencing nature and making that part of life. And so I love to see it when kids get that opportunity. And at this point in my life, I've done a lot outdoors, and I'm grateful and thankful. But let's talk about formative experiences and my mom and dad. So I do recall when I was about 12 years old, we were on vacation in New Hampshire. And by the way, I grew up in Chicago, so it was an urban environment, not a lot of nature besides a few trees growing in front of the house. And in New Hampshire, we went on a hike up Mount Jefferson. And I'm sure we would have been the classic unprepared hikers wearing blue jeans and no maps and compass. We had a little bit of a picnic lunch. And my father, lost in thought, you know, strolled ahead. And my mom worried about the fog. And the two kids, we sort of bounced back and forth between them. So no big deal, just a family vacation. But that was 50 years ago. And I still remember that. And by the time I got to college, you know, I wanted to do Outward Bound. And where did that idea come from? So I think those the formative experiences for kids can be really important. Just a little exposure to the outdoors, that might be the seed. So for sure, thank you, Mom. Thank you, Dad. Among all the other great things you've done for me, that trip up Mount Jefferson was life-changing.
So Ken, you've become known, among other things, for barefoot hiking. Tell me about that. Why? When did you discover that this was something you might want to try? And do you always hike barefoot?
So today, most of what I do is barefoot. But, you know, I started for reasons that were 1,000% pragmatic. Because in the famous book, Born to Run, Chris McDougall argued that, you know, barefoot training could help you avoid overuse injuries by getting you back into a more natural gait and a more natural form. And the theme here is that technology has great benefits, but it also has costs. And shoes can mess up, for some people, your form and predispose you to injuries. So I was exploring it. And, you know, barefoot running is hard. But I got this idea, why don't I try a barefoot hike? And I went up Peekamoose. And the huge surprise to me was how much fun it was. And it's, you know, not necessarily fun in the sense that, you know, rocks are not comfortable to walk on for sure. But you get this amazing contrast between the annoying gravel, and then you get up to the top and it's the smooth, dark mud in the boreal zone, or a smooth sandstone slab or moss. And it's that contrast that makes it just wild. So it's, you know, definitely type two fun, but it was so engaging that I rapidly lost interest in shoes.
Explain type two fun.
Well, type two fun is the fun that's maybe not fun in the moment. It's got an element of challenge and pain, like running an ultra marathon. So barefoot is definitely like that. It's got the intensity and the challenge, but it's just a, you know, empowering and super engaging experience.
Have your feet developed resistance to pain or discomfort in a way that they hadn't when you first started doing this?
No.
No?
feet are soft. And, you know, as you do more barefoot, you get, you know, some thicker skin. But feet are never going to be as strong as rocks or as particularly gravel. And so what barefoot teaches you is to be mindful. You've got to place your feet carefully. It's more about form. And instead of, you know, tromping or trudging through the wilderness, you place your feet. It's more like prowling through the forest. And, you know, that's what people did for a million years before we invented shoes. And shoes are great because they allow you to go so much faster, but you lose something. There's always a trade-off.
So let's get right to the grid. You have written a new book. It's called Chasing the Grid: An Ultra Runner's Physical and Spiritual Journey in Pursuit of the Ultimate Mountain Challenge. What is the grid?
Well, Brett, many of your, you know, listeners will be familiar with the Catskill 3500 Club, which has designated a list of high peaks. And that's the way beginning hikers get engaged with the Catskills. They say, okay, here's a list of the peaks. I will go visit them. And by doing so, I qualify to be a member of the club, and I get a patch and a certificate. It's sort of a structured way to get into hiking in the mountains. And every mountainous region in the country pretty much has a list of high peaks and typically a club and some kind of recognition. Now, the grid takes it to the next level. To complete the grid, you have to do the list of high peaks in each month of the year. Now, it doesn't have to be 1 year. You can take as long as you want to complete the grid. But by the time you're done in the Catskills, you would have 35 high peaks times 12 months is 420 separate climbs. So it's a big project. It's very simple. The goal is to get to know the mountains really well, to see them at all points in the year as they change from spring to summer to fall to winter. And at the same time, the goal is to learn about yourself as you go through these experiences.
So 35 peaks. Each peak is climbed 12 times a year, but not necessarily in the same year. So in other words, you're going to hike Slide Mountain every month of the year and
That's right.
Get a sense of what that mountain is like throughout the calendar.
Yeah, and it's such a cool experience because you're going to hike Slide Mountain in summer when the air is hot and sticky and still. You're going to be there in May when the black flies are buzzing around your head and nipping at you. You're going to be there in December, and maybe there will be, you know, 3 or 4 inches of snow, or in February, and maybe those ladders on the far side of Slide are totally covered in ice, and you're trying to get down in your snowshoes without twisting your ankles. So the experiences are totally different, and that's what creates such a powerful experience with 420 experiences, which are all wildly different. And as a person, you keep changing. So some days you're out there and you're full of energy and you're feeling great. And some days you're dragging along and depressed by the fog and the cloud and clouds and the grayness. So it becomes a very powerful experience as you accumulate these 420 climbs.
And so it's more than a physical challenge. It's a mental challenge. It's a form of meditation, maybe, and inward reflection.
Oh, absolutely. And some people will describe it as a spiritual practice. Now, when I started the grid, I was, you know, full of energy. I was a frustrated ultra runner who was dealing with injuries. And I was like, well, here's a different project I can undertake. And I just threw myself into it, still in the mindset of thinking of everything as a physical challenge. And everything we do outdoors has a physical challenge component, of course. But I quickly became entranced by the sights and sounds. So I had, you know, read Thoreau's famous essay about autumnal tints, the beautiful colors of our sugar maples and red maples and everything else in the fall. I discovered the grid in early January, and I headed out immediately with the goal to start categorizing the tints of winter, which are more subtle. Although sometimes you have a gray day that's cloudy, and suddenly the clouds break and you have the shock of electric turquoise blue from the sky shining through. So the winter is different from the fall. That was my initial fascination. And as I started to finish up the project, I began thinking about integrating the lessons of the mountains back into my, you know, daily life in the cubicle behind the laptop, and how I could combine the passion of the outdoors with the, you know, the need to be productive.
How did you find the time with your, you know, day job and everything else in life to get this done? And how long did it take you? I know that speed wasn't part of this particular challenge, but I'm curious how long the challenge took.
When I discovered the grid, which was quite coincidental and very random, you know, I had already been running and hiking in the Catskills for many years. You know, things like the Escarpment Trail Run or that long path through run I mentioned. So I discovered that I had already completed about a quarter of the grid, just coincidentally. And of course, that made it feel like I was almost done. And I was not, because having 300 more peaks to do is a lot. And I have an attitude when I'm taking on a meaningful and important project, I want to get it done. I want to get it done fast because life goes on and, you know, health is not guaranteed, time is not guaranteed, other things come up. So I really threw myself into it and I finished off the remaining 300 in 2 years. By the way, it did require taking a leave of absence from work. So to your point, time, you know, was a bit of an issue, particularly for the winter climbs, which can be quite slow. But yeah, after 30 or 35 years working, I was starting to, my batteries were starting to run low. And part of what the grid was a way to do a reset. And this is my favorite Burroughs quote. You know, he said, "I go to nature to be soothed and healed." And that's how a lot of us think about it. You know, it's a break from the day-to-day grind in the super high-tech digital world we live in. But he also said, "I go to nature to have my senses put in tune once again." And that's what I mean by a reset. And so as I spent time on the grid and back in nature, I was learning, you know, not only the idyllic experiences of nature, the beautiful fall days or the other joyful experiences, but also the painful and challenging aspect. You know, some people love the winter, but not me. I do better in the heat and I'm a summer person. And so the winter climbs could be quite difficult if there were 2 or 3 feet of snow and you're post-holing to your knees, you know, and you're not going at the rhythmic, you know, consistent pace that runners are used to. You're going, you know, a mile an hour. You're going sometimes a mile in 2 hours if you're breaking trail. Or once I climbed fir straight through the woods and it was very steep and it was heavy snow and the sun came out and it started melting. And that was 1 mile in 3 hours. And so I started thinking, you know, nature is painful as well as pleasurable, but you get this range of experiences. And that's where the passion comes from. And so the tail end of the grid was a project of integration in the sense that I wanted to bring that passion and excitement from the outdoors world back to my cubicle, if you will, and, you know, find the excitement there again. Because life is too short to be dragging yourself through things that are no longer fun.
And did it stick?
Yes.
And gave you a new spin on your career?
Yes, it really did. It really did. It was a huge reset. You know, as I emerged in my mid-50s, for all the hiking and running I had done, I felt like I was in the desert and needed water, but I just needed more nature in my life, and a lot more nature. And isn't this, you know, it's sort of surprising, again, given how much I've done, there is this question, how much nature do you need in life? And for some of us, the answer might be a lot.
And the grid gives it to you.
That's right.
You say in your book, "Indeed, my mind was positively spinning, for the grid seemed like an opportunity to channel my energy into a distinctive goal where speed would no longer matter." And so this was a whole new type of challenge for you.
That's right.
Other challenges have been very speed-oriented.
That's right. And speed's still important to me. One of the things I've learned painfully over the years is there's a right speed for everything you do. And sometimes it's all out. You know, I was just at a 5K yesterday, and I ran what, for me now, was pretty much all out. But when you're in the mountains, there are different speeds, and sometimes they're quite slow, and that's the right way to move.
John Burroughs also wrote, and you quote him in your book, "You must have the bird in your heart before you can find it in the bush." And you say, "6 months ago, I'd never heard of a nuthatch. Now they followed me everywhere." So I think that's another thing that separates something like the grid from other challenges that are, you know, set up to get them done as quickly as possible. And the grid, with its revisits to the same place, you're noticing things that would just pass you by.
That's right. And John Burroughs wrote, "To learn something new, take the path you took yesterday."
Yeah.
But the nuthatches were funny. And, you know, the grid was a different experience for me because as an ultra runner, I was, you know, totally focused on moving through the forests. And I was so intrigued by the sights and the sounds and the patterns, but they flew past at speed and it was hard to notice things. But while doing the grid at a slower pace, I began to see how much there was. I was just out bushwhacking the other day and somehow I had noticed bindweed, but I had never gotten quite as tangled up in it as I did. This was Pack Saddle in Pine Island on the way to Evergreen. I've never seen so much bindweed, and it crawled up into like waist-high ferns, and it created just a complete mess to get through. But, you know, everything is different, and you start seeing and observing. The book Chasing the Grid has an appendix, and I list out 300 species of different things I identified while I was in the mountains. Not because, you know, I'm a botanist, I'm not, or a naturalist, but it was so cool to start to recognize the other people in the forest and learn their names, whether they were trees or flowers or frogs or bugs or lichens or moss or funguses. So there's just a whole world. One of the things about the grid that was truly amazing for me was it taught me to open my eyes and see things, which is what we're talking about. And again, it's back to that theme of technology. And we all know this with Google Maps, it gets us where we're going. But if you're like me, I have no idea how I got there. And I would never be able to find my way back. It's the same thing in the mountains. I've talked to people and they're like, "Oh yeah, we've been to the Catskills. We couldn't see anything." And, you know, in the summer, the vegetation is quite thick. But as you're out there, you learn to start seeing the small things. And so, for example, the trail from Table to Lone, which is a social trail, it's not an official trail, I think it took a half a dozen visits out there before I finally found it. I always would slip too far downhill towards the Neversink and miss the saddle. One day I just stopped and I said, "Look, I've got to follow the crest of the ridge." And I realized that there were little sparkles of light. You couldn't really see much in the first spruce thickets, but there were little sparkles of light. And when they equalized on either side, you realized, okay, I'm on the exact crest. And when I finally got that right, there was the trail right in front of my feet where it was supposed to be. And it just took me multiple tries to find it. Or the other amazing thing is you're out bushwhacking and you're trying to find your way to some mountain. And it's, of course, completely invisible in the thick foliage until you see it through a gap in the leaves. And it's only a few inches wide, but there in the distance is a little line of spiky trees. And they're a little bit duller green because they're farther off. And you're like, "That's the shoulder. And now I know where the mountain is," just from that little tiny clue. So that was a great lesson from the grid. You know, the mountains taught me how to, you know, open my eyes and see again.
I feel like you were starting to write a little bit like Burroughs in some of this book. And there's a particular excerpt that I pulled that I think is a great example of that. Would you mind reading?
Sure.
This paragraph here in bold.
"The trees here were strong and good looking, like young athletes, and wearing such fine jewelry, clumps of beard lichen hanging a foot or longer, thin plates of hooded tube and hammered shield lichen filigreed upon the bark, pale green tufts and tendrils of ghost antler and boreal oak moss sprouting from the twigs. Now, I went through a phase where I was just totally obsessed by lichens. And so you're seeing a little bit of that in this paragraph. But what Burroughs and especially Muir convey, they convey the life that's in the forest. And, you know, philosophers and scientists debate and have for centuries and continue to this day, what is consciousness? What is the spirit? What is the soul? And when you're in the modern world, there's a tendency to self-identify with like your driver's license. That's me. That's my serial number. And that's my license to operate a vehicle subject to the rules and regulations and liabilities, you know, thereof. But when you're out in the mountains, you realize the sense of self expands and becomes much more inclusive and connective. And that's Burroughs and Muir are such great authors at conveying that sense. And something like the grid will help, you know, the rest of us experience a little bit of that.
That metaphorical prose, I think, could come straight out of one of Burroughs' essays.
Yeah, and Burroughs, too, you know, he uses quaint terms like, you know, manliness and virility, which we don't use today because we recognize men and women and other people, you know, all have strength. But there is a sense of strength and the importance of strength running through his writing. And I think part of the what the mountains do is they teach you to be strong, to manage yourself in a wild environment. And, you know, that's not something we want to lose.
More from Ken Posner, plus a conversation with Jennifer Zack of the New York-New Jersey Trail Conference, right after this.
Congress told us to go fund yourself. So that's what we're doing. Radio Catskill is fighting to keep local news, culture, and NPR alive. Federal cuts are closing stations and silencing voices. But with your support right now, we'll stay loud, proud, and independent. Keep the programs you love and help us serve the community. Go to WJFFradio.org and fund the future of public media today.
How we make sense of the news and the world keeps changing. Who to trust and what's real are other moving targets. Let On the Media be your guide.
Saturday afternoon at 4.
How did you celebrate finishing the grid? Or did you?
A lot of the grid I did by myself, in part because I was at various points in various different statuses of being injured and moving more slowly than a lot of my trail running friends. The last hike, I invited a lot of friends to come, and we did it as I decided to make it a unique, minimalist, adventurous kind of deal. And of course, it was Catterskill High Peak. It had to be Catterskill. And it was in December, and I decided, why don't we make it a little bit more interesting by hiking it at night without lights? So we got a group of folks together, and a friend brought a bottle of champagne. I don't drink anymore, but I didn't bring any water, and I got thirsty, so I had a few swigs at the top. But the fun was finding our way through the forest. And, you know, of course, the moon went behind clouds, but it's amazing what you can see, even with diluted, you know, ambient moonlight. And when there's snow on the ground, of course, it allows you to see a lot. Trying to go through the forest in the summer without any lights at all is quite a bit more difficult. Hmm.
We've touched on this a few times, but if you could sum up, what did the grid teach you about yourself?
Well, the grid taught me a lot about myself. And in the book, I talk about coming face to face with my inner demon, who happened to be this long dead spirit of some scout or messenger who was frustrated because he could no longer run, which was sort of strangely reminiscent of my own situation at that point. And so I, you know, back to your question, Brett, about, you know, the energy, right? The inner demon would tend to push me to move fast, and it would tend to get extremely frustrated when I couldn't. And sometimes, especially barefoot, I would get quite frustrated. I remember going up Southwest Hunter, and it was in October. And I showed up barefoot, and the car thermometer was like 32 degrees. And I'm like, this is not good. This is not what I was hoping for in a nice fall day. But I went on anyhow. And as I was bushwhacking up Southwest Hunter from Diamond Notch, from the lean-to on the pass or the saddle, I noticed there were specks of frost on the ground. And I'm like, okay, I need to move quickly to generate body heat to keep, you know, my feet at risk from going numb, which is not a good idea. And, you know, at that point, I got tangled up a long beech branch or something, snagged my backpack and, you know, just held me up for a second. And I started to get sort of frustrated and mad. And it's like, I've got to keep moving quickly to generate body heat. And then I got into just a massive tumble of rocks and I had to pick my way through this stuff. And there was no way to move fast at all. And the wind was starting to pick up and my feet were starting to go numb. And it was just total frustration. And I think I started shouting out loud in, you know, in frustration. And I remember my agent read that part of the earlier draft and she was like, Ken, do you have a anger management problem? And I don't think so, but I think I've got the same challenge that a lot of us have. We have energy. We're operating in a complex environment and we encounter challenges and we got to figure out our way through these challenges. And that means managing that energy so it doesn't get out of control. And that's hard when the stakes are high. So by the way, I was able to finally get on top of the mountain. But the barefoot was, you know, part of me realized I needed to work on patience, more self-management, more self-control. And some of the grid was about that.
Did you do the whole thing barefoot?
Well, and that, not the whole grid, but that trip I did.
Yeah.
I got up to the top of Southwest Hunter and then I jogged along the Fenwick Lumber Railroad Trail to towards Hunter, you know, dodging the columnar ice, the little ice spikes on the trail. And somebody saw me passing Hunter and they posted, I saw this crazy barefoot guy on Hunter and it was 26 degrees. So that was my best cold exploit. And then I came down the other side and I saw a butterfly wing lying on the trail. And I thought, you know, how sad, it's past the season for those sparks of color in life. So that trip was all barefoot and no permanent damage, although my feet were sore for the next few days. But yeah, you asked about what did I learn about myself. It's just practice and trying to be more in control and learn to manage myself and, you know, make myself more useful and more reliable and more dependable and therefore more able to do the other things I have to do in life.
There's, I think, an element of asceticism to some of how you take on these challenges, the barefooted hiking, the lack of food and water in some cases. And I guess that also contributes to mental development. And also maybe I've gone through this. I can certainly handle this, whatever confronts you in life.
That's right. And there's a point in the book where I talk about frustrations at work, you know, some new project being dumped on my lap and my boss tagging along on a trip somewhere. And it's like, well, you know, this is annoying, but it's not as bad as a first spruce thicket when you get stuck in a bad one. So I'll let you in on what I think is a secret, because in the Western tradition, you know, asceticism is associated with self-denial. And it doesn't look like much fun, right? It's by, you know, people, religious people maybe, who are undertaking the world's sins and pains in reflection of the fact that we're all fallen people. But if you go back to the ancient Greeks, they had a term, ascesis, which is the same root word. But it wasn't necessarily meant to connote a lifestyle of self-denial. It was more about an athletic practice, or a practice for developing both athletic and spiritual qualities. And so physical challenges, including going without food and water and feats of endurance, and of course going barefoot, that's how the Greeks competed and exercised back in the day. That was thought to be part of just how you developed yourself. So it wasn't about self-denial. It was just about finding and developing your inner strength. And I think in other traditions around the world, you'll find that too. For example, in the Northwest, the Yurok Indians have a traditional training practice, which they call Hohkep. And it involves the same disciplines, going without food and water and getting out on the trails and getting out at night and in bad weather. And they describe this practice on the one hand as a way of seeking spiritual powers from the spirit world. But on the other hand, it's also a way to make yourself strong, to make your mind strong, so that you can achieve your purpose in life instead of being somebody else's pet, which is the word that some of those informants use. So these kinds of training traditions, I think, are universal or nearly universal in cultures around the world. And the real secret is, when you go out and do this stuff, it's a lot of fun. It's the type two fun. It's the fun that's intense. It has pain as well as pleasure and excitement. But, I as odd as it sounds, getting out in the beautiful Catskills Mountains and whatever kit or setup you have, it's joy. It's experience. It's intensity. It's the beauty of the natural world. And I think if you can get some of that into your life, it makes you a happier, more positive person. And then you can share that positivity with other people. And that's the energy we all need just to go out and do our job.
What do you hope readers take away from this book?
Well, I'm not trying to specifically encourage, more grid aspirants. But I think getting people outdoors is good. But also, the grid for me was a pivot. It was a project. It wasn't a race. It was more like a pilgrimage. And so I do think pilgrimage is a useful concept for us in this super high-tech digital world. And historically, a pilgrimage meant going away somewhere. And so I'd like to suggest there's another way to do this, which is, sometimes I call it a synthetic pilgrimage. Instead of picking up and leaving and going somewhere else, you can start to use those weekends and a little bit of vacation time to work on this kind of project. And as you work on the project, it's specifically to learn about yourself. And you're taking yourself off the path of productivity, out of the cubicle, out of the shopping mall, and you're going into a wild environment, unmanaged environment, which is going to force you to learn about yourself. And I think, these kinds of projects can really produce great opportunities to learn and develop and maybe change your direction ever so slightly. Because the modern world is totally happy if you're just productive and do the same thing over and over and over again, and then you're done. And it's like, well, was that it? So I'd love to see more people think about projects and learning and taking charge of their direction. So that would be, I guess, the real hope.
Great. Well, I really enjoyed the book, and thank you for taking some time to talk about it. This has been fantastic.
I'm just delighted, Brett. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Ken Posner's book, Chasing the Grid: An Ultra Runner's Physical and Spiritual Journey in Pursuit of the Ultimate Mountain Challenge, is available now wherever books are sold. And if you're hankering for a little challenge of your own, now is the perfect time to join the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference's annual Trail-a-thon, a community-driven fundraiser that helps preserve tomorrow's trail lands. For more on that, I spoke with Jennifer Zack at the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference. Jennifer, could you please just introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Jennifer Zack, and I'm the Charitable Gifts and Events Manager at the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference.
And the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference is integral to our network of Catskills Trails. Can you explain what your organization does and the area that it covers?
The Trail Conference has been around since 1920, so for over 100 years, we've been building, protecting, and maintaining trail lands throughout northern New Jersey and southern New York, including the Catskills. And we get this work accomplished through our network of volunteers. We have about 200 volunteers who donate about 100,000 hours annually to get that work done on the ground. So we definitely takes an army, and there is a wide variety of volunteer opportunities that people take on to complete those tasks. We have trail maintainers making sure the blazes are kept up, cutting back the brush on all your beloved trails while you're out there. We have trail stewards who are set up at popular trailheads. Most importantly, some in the Catskills, the recent boom of hiking, especially in regions that have sensitive ecosystems. We want to make sure that people have a great time, but that they understand how to be out there on the trails. So our trail stewards are letting folks know the severity, like, is this a strenuous trail? Do you have enough water? Is your foot, you know, your shoe wear appropriate for the journey you're about to embark on? So trail stewards are invaluable. We also have our invasive species program. Unbeknownst to a lot of people, when you're going out in on your favorite hike, you're bringing some invasives on your shoes. So we have boot brushes installed, but our invasives team is going out there and identifying emerging invasives. So we're able to tackle those emerging invasives so that we can make sure that when you're out there on your favorite trails, that it'll continue to look like your favorite trails over time and not become overgrown by invasives that are just going to take over the understory. You know, we have our office volunteers who help the administration back end process donations, answer phone calls. So it really does take a village. And then we have our park partners and government agencies that we work hand in hand with to make sure that the user experience is pristine.
Yeah, I think it will come as a surprise to many that the trails aren't built by the state directly, right? So they're built and maintained for the most part by your organization in collaboration with the state?
Absolutely. I agree with you. I think that it's a misconception that taxes go directly to parks and recreational areas to manage the trail system, but they have no bandwidth for that. And they rely on the Trail Conference and our volunteers to help make sure and ensure the safety of people who are going out on the trails. So, yeah, we work hand in hand with them, advising with them on any trail updates and making sure that we're following all the protocols, and they lean on us for projects as well.
How does the Trail Conference fund its operations? And this might be a nice segue into Trailathon as a component of that.
Sure. So the Trail Conference funding, we're a nonprofit 501c3. So we rely on the generosity of donations from private individuals through our membership and donations. And we also work with grants and contracts. But a large portion of it is through the generosity of people like you.
So how does Trailathon work? How do I sign up as a hiker? And what are the dates associated with that?
Sure. Our centennial year was in 2020, and obviously that might have been a little bit of a tough year. So we had to figure out, how do we celebrate the Trail Conference, but we might not be able to come together? So instead of a gala that year, we came up with a concept called Trailathon. And so we're going into our sixth year of the Trailathon, and this is a really great way for everybody to get involved. It's not about how far you go or climbing the highest peak. It's about getting out there and advocating and spreading the message of the Trail Conference and supporting the advancement of our mission. It could be done anywhere, anytime, any place, and it goes through October 31st. So it is a peer-to-peer fundraiser, and what that means is it's $100 to sign up. You get a super neat hat. We have this cool limited edition Trailathon hat that was made for this year, and you can donate that $100 directly yourself, or you can look to your network of you know, your friends and families. People are likely to want to cheer you on in your efforts, so that could also help you meet your $100 goal. But we encourage everybody to strive to gain a little bit more than their $100. So there's the fundraising component. And you get milestone prizes along the way, starting at $250. But it's also, you get to have a friendly competition and submit your mileage. You know, I'm a busy mom of two small kids, so I always say that it can be done anywhere, anyhow, fit it in. And it really gives you that incentive to go out there and connect with nature. And I think sometimes in our busy life, we really need that reminder. So the trail-a-thon is a really excellent way of having that reminder, like, okay, you know, I went for a walk today. It was a mile. Well, great. Awesome. Clock that mile. You're able to submit your mileage and a fun incentive. We are entering our 105 year being part an organization in this area. So we have an extra little challenge that if folks reach 105 miles, they get a neat little custom made wooden medal, which is really special. And each year it will go up 1 mile. Maybe this year will be my year, but maybe not. And that's okay, because I'm still out there. I'm tugging along, you know, two small kids with a backpack of snacks. So, you know, I might only get to 60 miles in 31 days, and that's fantastic. And it's fantastic for everybody who wants to have an excuse to be a little bit motivated, but not in a crazy, you know, no one's expecting you to do 10 miles a day.
Yeah, fantastic. And what a nice way to explore the trail network by getting out there and plugging away at those miles and earning some money through the challenge to donate to the trail conference.
Yeah. And what a perfect way. It's the fall foliage season. You can hike your way through the peak season and see the changes of the colors. And another great thing about the trail-a-thon is that we want to hear your story. We want to hear why you're hiking. Over these 5 years, I've had folks come in and they might have hit a milestone of 25 miles and they were the first one. You also get a prize for that. And we would ask them, well, why are you taking this? And you know, I was just thinking maybe they would be, oh, I needed to be a little bit more motivated. The responses have been phenomenal. You know, we've had an individual say that they were in remission from cancer, and this was something that they wanted to take part of to show themselves that they can get back into it. I was blown away by that response. We've had another person who hit a milestone that it was their first year in retirement, and they wanted to do this to keep active, motivated, and give back. And so it's an opportunity for us to hear from you. The Trail Conference does a lot of great work in the woods. We always say we're like the little gnomes. You're not supposed to know that we were there, but we don't connect with the trail users as much as we would like. So this is a wonderful opportunity to help shine a spotlight on your great trail experiences that the Trail Conference and our partners help make possible.
So Jennifer, how do we sign up?
Okay, great. So if you go over to runsignup.com/NYNJTC trailathon, you'll land on our page. You could also go to our direct website and there should be a slider and you'll be all set and on your way to, you know, being part of the trail-a-thon. And over the course of our 5 years, we've had nearly 800 participants. So we would really love to have you. We would really love to hear your story and share in your enthusiasm.
And your website is?
NYNJTC.org.
Terrific. Jennifer, Zach, thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Brett, for having us and for being a champion of the Catskills and a partner of the New York New Jersey Trail Conference.
Good luck with the trail-a-thon. Sounds like fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of CatsCast, right here on WJFF Radio Catskill. CatsCast, the Catskills podcast, has its home at catscast.com, where stories are archived, transcribed, and searchable. I'm Brett Barry, and this is CatsCast.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Bank, Sullivan County's oldest independent community bank, offering deposit and loan products for more than 110 years. Members FDIC and Equal Housing Lender. National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry Identification Number 405318. More information at jeff.bank. And from the Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association, dedicated to promoting the Sullivan County Catskills. SullivanCatskills.com. And from listeners like you.
Don't miss Double Down on Radio Catskill, our free party happening tomorrow afternoon at the Arnold House with fun activities for kids and adults, free hors d'oeuvres, cash bar, music by DJ Tikka Masala. It's a free party and a fundraiser, so we also have a silent auction. And for donations of $50 or more, your chance to win gift cards from great local businesses. So ramble on up Chandelier above Livingston Manor and double down for Radio Catskill. 2 to 5 tomorrow at the Arnold House.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.